Ladies and gentlemen, direct from Cicero, the Kelly Sister.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. It's Friday night, and we're talking about the history of the movie musical, from Al Jolson and the Jazz Singer to the latest Broadway to silver screen hit, Chicago.
Come on, babe, when we paint the town, and all that jazz, I'm gonna rouge my knees and roll my stockings down. And all that jazz.
The 1975 Broadway smash, Chicago, made it to the silver screen nationwide today. Many in Hollywood see Chicago as the make-or-break release for a sputtering genre. For 25 years, the movie musical has been losing ground in the minds of a generation that gets its song and dance fix from music video and MTV. But for decades, from the birth of talking films until the 1960s and 70s, the energetic song and dance movie with a story was a Hollywood staple. Tonight on Point, we're going to take a walk through the history of the movie musical. From 42nd Street to Cabaret to Grease, we'll ask why it's almost gone away and if it can ever be popular again in a form that Fred Astaire or Gene Kelly would recognize. What is your favorite movie musical? And what is it about those magic films, many decades old, that we keep revisiting again and again? In 2003, is the movie musical on its last legs? Or is there a 21st century life for song and dance and action? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. With us in the studio tonight is Garen Daly, Artistic Director for the Dedham Community Theater in Dedham, Massachusetts, and On Point's movie maven. Good evening and welcome, Garen Daly.
Hi, Tom.
Great to have you back. And from Cortland, New York, we're joined by Thomas Hischak, Professor of Theater at the State University of New York in Cortland and author of the American Musical Theater Song Encyclopedia. His upcoming book is Through the Screen Door, What Happened to the Broadway Musical When It Went to Hollywood. Good evening and welcome, Thomas Hischak.
Hi.
Hi, great to have you. Also joining us from Hanover, New Hampshire tonight is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Welcome to the cabaret, Jack.
Thank you, Tom, and hello to our guests.
Well, we've got a lot of music and a lot of films to look at tonight. But Garen Daly, give us just the top line first. Is it really all that bad? Are people really watching Chicago and saying, if this goes down, forget about Les Mis, forget about Sweeney Todd, forget about Phantom of the Opera, they're not coming to the big screen?
Yeah, people are looking at it really closely, and they're unrolling, you know, they're bringing the film up very slowly. They want to make sure it's going to get some awards and get some notoriety. It's gotten some very good critical response. I loved it when I saw it. I thought it was, you know, it got me jazzed, you know, and I kept thinking about Bob Fosse and all the great moves that he brought to the screen.
I saw it this afternoon and I wasn't quite as thrilled, and I'm kind of a musical buff, but okay. Well,
you know, I think what I'd like to say at this point is I think that, you know, what we're seeing with Moulin Rouge and with Chicago is a breakaway from some of the old school stuff, and I think we're seeing a new school developing. So to get back to your question, mm-hmm. I think we will be seeing more musicals come along, but they're going to be different. They're not going to be the same old, same old.
Is that you, Jack?
Yeah, it is. I'm just wondering if Anthony Lane was right when he wrote, "The songs in Chicago crash in one ear, barge around in your brain for a minute or two, then make a swift exit through the other ear, never to be heard again."
Well, all that jazz, I have to say, was sticking with me this afternoon, but some of the others, I don't know. Thomas Hischak, what is it about the musical, the movie musical, I guess the experience of watching, of getting engaged with it, is it fundamentally different from a kind of narrative-driven movie?
It is, and there's several reasons for that. You have to remember that movie musicals and talkies come in at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
There's no such thing as a movie that talked that never sang. And the only reason that they put sound in The Jazz Singer, the movie that you're going to talk about, is because people wanted to hear singing.
And as soon as they got that talk, that sound, was music.
They heard the singing, they loved it, but then also snuck in between there were a couple lines of dialogue, and to the surprise of everyone, they loved that too. We have talking movies today because of musicals. So, yes, there's something fundamentally different about it, but it seems to be one of the germinal ideas of why we have movies is because people wanted to hear singing and talking. They could see dancing. They could see action. You know, the silent movies covered that pretty well. But something came in with a jazz singer, and it wasn't just talkies. It was the American musical. And no other country has ever managed to repeat that. We're having trouble repeating it. But all
right
those
now.
Years, all the, you know, the French movie tried and the English, and they never really got what Hollywood managed to do for, well, for a good length of time, at least 50, 60 years.
We're going to get a lot of the flavor of that long lineage tonight, but you brought up the jazz singer, 1927. Garen, we've got a clip for that. Remind us of this film.
Now, this is made in 1927. It is essentially the first sound film made, but only 25% of it was sound. The rest of it was silent with the cue cards. And what starts off is Al Jolson, who is a megastar and really made the movie. He was a marquee draw. He bursts on the stage with these words.
You want to hear Twit Twit Twitsy? All right, hold on, hold on. Twit Twit Twitsy, goodbye. Twit Twit Twitsy, don't cry. The little choo choo train that takes me away from you. You don't know just how sad it makes me.
I just love the idea that the first sound Americans heard at the movie was Toot Toot Tootsie. Thomas Hischek, what was the response of audiences when this sound came pouring out and there it was, Al Jolson with that crazy, funny, catchy song?
Right. Well, movies had taken them places where they'd never gone before. And they'd seen stars, but there was something about, you know, seeing a star like Al Jolson, hearing him in, you know, in Paducah, Kentucky. You know, I mean, it was the idea that the great stage star was now right in front of you on the screen, and you heard him and you saw him, and there was something special about that.
And above all, you heard him, and here we are, bird whistles in the works, Gary.
Yeah.
There's two things I want to bring up here. First is, one of the things that Hollywood did was they went out and immediately started buying musical publishing houses to get these songs onto the air and onto the screens. And in fact, one tagline was, the 300 feet of Broadway are now 3,000 miles across country. You know, they were bringing it to the masses.
Right. Right.
But something really interesting here, when Al Jolson says, wait a minute, this is an ad lib. This was not in the script. And not only that, it's product placement because Al Jolson was pushing one of his new songs, You Ain't Heard Nothing Yet.
We're shocked. We are shocked.
Yeah. The first sounds come out and it's product placement. Same thing as always.
Thomas Hischek, when the sound first came to the movies, did audiences demand music? Did they want music every time in? Were musicals at one time more popular than straight narrative-driven dramas?
No, it's gone through some pretty tough cycles. Jazz singer was very popular. The singing and the talking. And, of course, everybody started making talking movies, not just musicals. But that's 1927. By 1929, 1930, there were so many musicals. They were cranking them out as fast as they can. They were buying every property on Broadway. They were quickly making them into movies. And, frankly, a lot of them weren't very good. Between Jazz Singer and 42nd Street, there is this lull. There's a couple of exceptions. By 1931, 32, the word was out. No more musicals. Audiences are tired of them. One looks like the other. Let's concentrate on talkies. And it wouldn't be until, I think it's 1933 with 42nd Street, that all of a sudden a movie musical opened that just took everyone by surprise and said, my God, we haven't seen it all. It was a whole new way of making a movie musical, and it affected musicals for the next, well, at least dozen years.
So they've come and gone from the beginning. 42nd Street, Garen, what was it about that musical that got people up in their chairs?
I think it's the visuals.
Yeah, Thomas is really right. In 1930, there were 70 musicals made. Mm. In 1931, there were 10. And in 1933, there were just a handful. But what happened in 1933 was that Busby Berkeley became the choreographer of 42nd Street, and he redefined the language of what the camera could do.
Right.
Before, it was very static. You would just watch what was going on. All of a sudden, he created gliding boom shots and mobile shots. Mm-hmm. And then there were thousands and thousands of girls dancing in these geometric shapes. But also, one of the things that's in 42nd Street is the classic backstage drama going on. The show must go on. You have to go out and do it. And it's, you know, up to Ruby Keeler to make everyone happy.
Right.
Sawyer, you listen to me. And you listen hard. 200 people, 200 jobs, $200,000, 5 weeks of grind and blood and sweat depend upon you. It's the lives of all these people who've worked with you. You've got to go on. You've got to give and give and give. They've got to like you. Got to. Do you understand? You can't fall down. You can't, because your future's in it. My future and everything all of us have is staked on you. All right, now I'm through. But you keep your feet on the ground and your head on those shoulders of yours and go out and saw you. You're going out a youngster. But you've got to come back a star.
Now that we have had the rice and flowers, the knot is tied. I can visualize such happy hours right by your side.
The honeymoon store is wonderful to adore. I'm going to take you for a ride. I'll go home and pack my panties. You go home and get your scanties, and away we'll go.
42nd Street, 1933, and Jack Beatty, right away here, we've got this kind of American dream of going into the show as a nobody and coming out a star. I guess movie musicals, all musicals, are kind of a real seedbed for that American dream in its glossiest form.
I think you're right. I mean, it's the plucky kids that were going to put on a show against the odds. But, you know, this particular movie and his later movies, this lush style, all that sequin, all those dancers, this was a visual antidote to the Depression. I mean, my God, if you can think of anything more opposite in spirit to the grimness of those years, it's this splash of joy in 42nd Street.
Thomas Ischeck, how did musicals do in general during the Depression?
Actually, they did better than ever. I think per person, I don't think we ever matched it. No movie today breaking all, you know, kind of money box office records really has the numbers that people went to during the Depression. Movies were cheap. Movies changed frequently. They made more. They saw more. I think it's interesting, too, you mentioned about becoming a star. Notice in the early movies, it was always a Broadway star.
Mm-hmm.
The first big musical talkie wins the Oscar is the Broadway Melody. Everybody's Broadway. Hollywood's always had this inferiority complex about Broadway, that's where the class was, that's where the great dramas
were. Right, the real
and
top hat.
So, in all the early movies, of course, what's the ideal you can do? They don't want to become a movie star. That comes later. No, they want to become the Broadway star.
Garen Daly, was it the same in the Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers era?
It was, but it was in a different kind of way. I mean, it's interesting. 1933 seems to be a watershed year. And we should also note out that it was Busby Berkeley as a choreographer making 42nd Street changed everything. He was new. He was fresh. Mm-hmm. Same thing was happening with Fred and Ginger. They were new and fresh, and what they brought was an intimate style. And one of the things, if you see a Fred and Ginger movie, you need to look at what's going on, because Fred Astaire, who was the choreographer of most of his stuff with Hermes Pans, would only take full shots of his entire body with him and Ginger as they were actually filming it. So it was a full shot, and you didn't change it, in contrast to what Busby Berkeley was doing. But the plots were very paper thin. It's always Fred finding girl, Fred losing girl, Ginger, and it's just the same old, same old.
We've got a clip from Shall We Dance, 1937. Shall we hear that?
Isn't it wonderful being here tonight like this? Still on the same boat together.
Oh, I seldom change boats in mid-ocean.
I mean, look how lucky I am. The first time I find myself on a boat with somebody like you, it turns out to be you.
At any gambling casino, from Monte Carlo to Reno, they tell you that a beginner comes out a winner.
Fred and Ginger, 1937, all full-body dancing shots. That is not what they do in Chicago in 2003, Garen Daly.
That's what we'll talk about later. This is old school, and that's what the Chicago is, new school. But again, it's wonderful Broadway productions, because they brought some of the very best Broadway composers out to make these films. Jerome Kern, Ira Gershner. These are great songs put together with really good artists and doing wonderful dance. And the audience wanted to do that. It was a courtship going on, and they liked the sexuality of these two people.
With all the music, we're talking tonight about the movie musical. What made movie musicals so popular for so long? And what's your favorite movie musical and why? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Put. We've got to take a short break. Let's go out listening to Blue Skies from the jazz singer. Here's Al Jolson.
Nothing but blue. moon skies from now on. Blue skies, smiling at me, 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 nothing but little blue skies. Do I see? Do. Bluebirds singing a song.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the movie musical.
Hey, we can't make this a musical.
What do you mean?
Lena. She can't act, she can't sing, and she can't dance. A triple threat.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. I am just about to be brilliant. Come here, Kathy. Come here. Now sing.
Huh?
I said sing. Good morning. Now, Don, keep your eyes riveted on my face.
All night through, good morning to you.
Watch my mouth.
Good morning. It's great to stay up late. Good morning to you.
Well, convincing?
Enchanting. What?
Don't you get it? Use Kathy's voice. Lena just moves her mouth and Kathy's voice comes over singing and talking for her.
That's wonderful.
Now, I couldn't let you do it, Kathy.
Why not?
Because you wouldn't be seen. You'd be throwing away your own career.
It has nothing to do with my career. It's only for this one picture. The important thing now is to save the Dueling Cavalier. Save Lockwood and Lamont.
Yeah.
Good morning.
We've talked the whole night through.
Good morning
to you.
1952, Singin' in the Rain, not the title song, and here we've got one of the greatest films of all time, I guess, Garen, and it's a satire on Hollywood and musicals.
Not only is it a satire on Hollywood and a musical, but it was a knockoff. What they were trying to do was they were trying to replicate what American in Paris had done the previous year, and they just kind of threw this film together very quickly, and as a result, it liberated everyone involved in it, because they weren't being constrained by the studio. They brought a very young director, Stanley Donen, who was only 28 years old, and they created something very vibrant and wonderful. It did okay at the box office, but it's only through time have we gone to recognize that this is one of the greatest American films of all time.
How did it do compared to American in Paris, one of my favorite all-time musicals?
American in Paris was a huge, huge hit, and it was also a very acclaimed hit. The only one that got an Oscar nomination out of this was Jean Hagen for her role as Lena Lamont, the nasal-voiced girl who couldn't talk.
And, of course, we just heard here Gene Kelly, Debbie Reynolds, Donald O'Connor. Thomas Hischak, what is it that musicals, movie musicals, can transmit that ordinary narrative-driven dramas can do not?
Well, the rule in theater is that music in a musical comes when dialogue isn't sufficient. You could talk up to a point, you could say I love you and I love you back, but you just need to go to the next level, and so the next level is usually singing, and then sometimes the next level beyond that would be dancing. Well, the same thing happens in the movie musical. We can now leave the real world of dialogue, even if it's not very realistic dialogue, and we can move to a higher level, an emotional level where it's beyond words, and that's what singing is. It's going beyond dialogue, prose, conversation, and then dance, maybe even a higher step up. And that's usually was in theater, that was the usual pattern. Boy talks to girl talks back, boy sings to girl, then girl sings back, and then boy and girl sing together, and then maybe they would go and dance together.
So we go to music when dialogue isn't enough, but when it's not sufficient. Not sufficient for what? Does it take us to
for
somewhere?
The emotions.
It's emotion.
On.
Is it also a kind of sublime or mythological plane we're at?
It could be all kinds of emotions. It could be a torch song that this person could say how bad he feels, but how much more effective it's going to be to sing it. Or the opposite, boy and girl fall in love and they want to express that and it's just full of optimism and joy. Well, dialogue will only do it so well. But when you can dance it, Fred Astaire dancing with his partner said much more than anybody could have written outside of Shakespeare.
Jack Beatty, that moment when the movie leaves the sort of surly bonds of earth and goes into music and dance is a kind of continental divide. Some people can make that leap and love to, others don't.
Yeah, I remember as a kid, the first one I saw was Oklahoma, and there was this literal field of corn, and there was the cowboy, and there was the bright morn, and so on. And I was just, even as a kid, I could see that the literalism of film, its verism, was working against the acceptance of there being a cowboy bursting into song. I call it sort of the Coleridge problem. You can't suspend your disbelief. And that has been a problem for me in musicals. titles for years. I love the numbers. But once we get back into the story, or rather, once we go from the story and we burst into song, my sort of plain man's sense of the story, I find it hard to take. Whereas on stage, where everything is artificial, easy. That's the way it goes.
Love the artifice on Broadway. For some people, harder to take in film. Garen, in West Side Story, 1961, even gang warfare was made the substance for song and dance.
Well, you know, that's true. But, you know, we have to look at West Side Story. It's still Romeo and Juliet. It's still a love story. The only real difference that, you know, Stephen Sondheim and Bernstein brought into this was the fact that they were now taking some serious issues that are dealing with the inner city, with, you know, ethnic conflict. But there's still a love story there. But, you know, the problem that I have with West Side Story is exactly what Jack was talking about, is that I do love the musical scenes. I love the dance scenes. But when they make the transition from talking amongst themselves and then going into dance and music, the transition just doesn't gel for me very well. Like this, in the segment on the Cool song. Here's an example.
Man, you want to get past the cops when they start asking about tonight? You play it cool. You want to live in this lousy world? Play it cool. I want to get even.
Get cool.
I want to bust cool.
I want to go.
Go cool. Boy, crazy boy. Get cool, boy. Got a rocket in your pocket. Keep coolie cool, boy. Don't get hot. 'Cause man, you've got some high times ahead. Take it slow, and daddy-o, you can live it up and die in bed. Boy, crazy boy, stay loose, boy.
West Side Story, 1961, and here musicals are grappling with big social questions. Garen, this isn't happy talk in the cornfield anymore. This is down and dirty in the city.
And again, what we're looking at here is we're seeing a shift in what's happening with the musical. But again, you know, we're talking about that transition. You know, these tough guys, what are they doing? They're going and doing this song. You know, it really didn't work for me. I mean, I have a problem with West Side Story, even though it did win 10 out of 11 Academy
And, of course,
Awards.
On Broadway and later as a film was hugely popular. Thomas Hischek, was there something going on in American culture by the 60s that was pulling Americans away from their easy embrace of the movie musical?
Well, West Side Story, which starts the 60s off and was so popular, they said winning all those awards and everything, it brought a class to the modern musical movie. I mean, everybody loved Gigi, everybody loved, you know, Singing in the Rain, but wow, this was a musical that was, well, trying to say something. Interesting that you picked Cool, because there's a number that is not one of the most famous songs from the show, but dance-wise, it's one of the pivotal numbers in theater, and I think movies as well.
All that finger-snapping is hard to forget.
Well, it's the finger-snapping, but, you know, dancing was always about joy. Dancing was about falling in love.
And here's menace.
Celebration. Now here is Jerome Robbins coming up with dancing that's ugly. It's showing all the frustration and the bitterness. And they talk about it a little bit, but these guys, all they could do is, they're not very literate guys. You know, they're gang guys. And they just can't express it any other way. Grunts, you know, and calling each other names. But all of a sudden with dance, they could just, all their frustrations come out. And it happened on the stage. And I think it's one of the more interesting scenes in the movie, because it's so unreal. At the same time, it's just people being purged, you know. Who thought that dance would go in that direction? Jerome Robbins, you know, all the brilliant things he did, the fact that a dance could do that. Without that, you couldn't have Cabaret. You couldn't have, I don't think, even Moulin Rouge in Chicago.
Well, it had to get modern with West Side Story, and it did. Cabaret began to address this problem. When people are no longer willing to have folks just suddenly break into song and dance in the middle of a conversation, Cabaret offered a formula to get out of that trap.
Right.
Yeah, and let's give credit to Bob Fosse, who was basically unbankable at the time when he was given the job of Cabaret. He stripped that down and created an incredible film. And, you know, you're dealing with a film, if you remember you know, the very opening sequence of Cabaret, you've got this kind of mirror thing going on, this distortion, and that's what's going to happen in the movie. You're going to see a distortion of what's going on stage, what is going on in Weimar, Germany after World War I, pre-Nazism, and it's really important. And wouldn't it be wonderful, or isn't it wonderful, that when you start, when you enter into this world of Cabaret, that and you're looking through this kind of distorted glass, you see an image and then a face, and then you just see the distorted face, and it's Joel Grey, and he is welcoming you to the Cabaret.
Meine Damen und Herren, Mesdames et Messieurs, Ladies und Gentlemen, comment ça va? Do you feel good? Ich bin euer Conferencier. I am your host und sage willkommen, bienvenue. Welcome im Cabaret, au Cabaret, au Cabaret. Leave your troubles outside. So, life is disappointing.
Again.
In here, life is beautiful. The girls are beautiful. Even the orchestra is beautiful.
Cabaret 1972, adapted from the 1966 Bob Fosse Broadway hit. Jack Beatty, here you didn't have to be a romantic to sink into the music at all.
No, it was right there on the stage of the Kit Kat Club. And, you know, while we cut from the club to the streets where we see Nazi toughs beating people up, and the decadence that we see in the club, in the leering of Joel Grey, in the sort of fleshy, you know, pockets of flesh showing above the sequins on the girls, you know, that becomes a metaphor for the society, a society about to just be transformed by the Nazi revolution. And interestingly enough, the only song that's sung outside the club comes at the end, and it's sung by this blonde in a beer garden. It's a young golden-haired youth, Hitler youth, no doubt, gets up and sings "Tomorrow Belongs to Me." Yeah. And you realize, oh my gosh, here's the antidote. Here's what's going to chase away all that decadence, this terrible health of this young man.
Cabaret is it's interesting because since we're looking at historically here,
yes.
Bob Fosse did in Cabaret, he turned around. He went back to 1933, took what Busby Berkeley had done and threw it out the window.
What do you mean by that?
Well, he got rid of all the songs that were character songs. Only songs are sung when you're in a club, except for the beer garden song.
Which gives it that feeling of realism.
Notice Busby Berkeley, he took a stage number, blew it up, made it huge, put the camera in all kind of weird places. What does Bob Fosse do in Cabaret? He makes it smaller than any Broadway show.
Meaning he draws the stage down to the spotlight almost.
Girls, and he put them on a 12 by 12 foot platform and did marvelous things. It was almost like he was going to say, movies don't have to do what Busby Berkeley did. They could do something even Broadway can't do, which is to zero right in on the stockings with the rips on it and the makeup and using his interesting camera angles and editing. He did something with Cabaret that you can't do in the theater and really, you can't do in movies very often unless you have that kind of a talent. So Cabaret is kind of almost a looking back at all those years of how you do movie musicals and saying, no, you know, we're going to go in this direction, and it worked beautifully.
Thomas Jeschek, how did the darkness of this movie strike people? With the palette of movie musicals is so vast. We've leapt over all kinds of Rodgers and Hammerstein, you know, big musicals, The King and I, Sound of Music, super popular musicals, and here was something dark and in your face and much less innocent than musicals tended to be.
Frankly, when I saw it, I loved it, and I remember thinking, this is going to die at the box office. No one is going to want to see this. This is too dark. And I was shocked and happily surprised to find not only was it popular, I knew it would win awards because it was arty, but beside that, it was actually very popular, and I think people were ready for it. I think they were ready for a movie that jarred their senses and sort of lulled them. And it's a movie that holds up beautifully. My students, they know that movie, and it speaks to them more clearly than, you know, several movies that old and movies that are not as old as that, because it still is a jarring movie. It still goes right for ideas and puts them in your face very quickly and creatively, and then just leaves you there to think about it.
Garen Daly, this was no Mary Poppins. This was no South Pacific. This was not the kind of huge landscape of American values and sugary sweetness and light that musicals had often held.
Well, you know, Bob Fosse was someone who, like Fellini, and there are a lot of similarities between Fosse and Fellini, that liked getting into that bodiness, that seemly side of society. And I think, you know, if we look back at the 30s and even into the 50s with musicals, there was a hopefulness that was always going on there. As we got into the 60s, we changed as a culture. And I think this film reflects some of that change. I don't think this film would have been successful if it was done in the 50s. Because we were ready for it, we wanted to see this, we needed to see some of this really deep, dark, understated, or the stated darkness that was going on. And interestingly, a wonderful technique that Fosse uses in that. There are two worlds in this. There's the outside world on the street, and then there's the world on the stage. The only person who crosses between those is the main character, Sally Bowles. She sings on stage, and she has a life outside. Otherwise, they're two distinct worlds.
Thomas Hischek, what about the impact of Broadway musicals? Has it been greater on the American public at large from the stage or from the silver screen? And I guess, look right across many of these that we've glossed over tonight, but the Rodgers and Hammerstein and others. Where do they become bigger?
Well, Hollywood's always depended on Broadway, you know, for plays as well as musicals. And whenever, later on, by the 50s, I would say, when the Rodgers and Hammerstein movies are being made, they were given the real class treatment. They were long, they kept all the songs in, they were almost reverent in some way. And people respected that because they said, oh, well, this is a Rodgers and Hammerstein classic. Mm-hmm. But it's switched, it's changed over the time. People don't have that reverence for Broadway anymore. There are a lot of people seeing Broadway musicals, they're as popular, if not more than ever. But it's not the popular culture that you're going to get from a movie. And obviously, Broadway shows, tunes are not on the radio, you know, as they were in the 50s. So you've split, you know, the culture in two ways. And I think today it's kind of reversed. And now look at our, you know, the best musicals being produced in this country are not being produced on Broadway. They're being done as films and not Broadway plays made into films, but original films. Animated films particularly seem to be taking up the space that used to be, oh, wait for the new Broadway show to be filmed. Well, we're waiting a long time. Evita was the most recent Broadway show to be filmed before Chicago this year, and that goes back to 96. And if you want to go before that, you have to go all the way back to 1975 or 6, I think it is, when they made A Chorus Line, which was a bomb, and Little Shop of Horrors, which was relatively successful.
Off-Broadway. We're going to come back and look at what's going on with musicals in the more recent past. We're talking about the movie musical tonight. My guest is Thomas Hischek, our movie maven Garen Daly, and our own Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation as well. What made movie musicals so popular for so long, and where should they go today? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Let's go out listening to Make Them Laugh from Singing in the Rain.
Take a fall, but a wall split a seam. You start off by pretending you're a dancer with grace. You wiggle till the giggle is all over the place. And then you get a great big custard pie in the face. Make them laugh, make them laugh, make them laugh. Make them laugh, don't you? All the...
For a cold late one night, my papa said everything's all right.
Nobody can imagine how dynamic it feels to be in a musical, because imagine you're on the set, you have your choreography down, you have this music blasting, and then the director says action, and you're off, you take off like a balloon in this other dimension. You know, you just feel alive.
Hand Jive from Grease, 1978, and John Travolta talking about the filming of Grease, the filming of musicals, being in musicals and going off into that other dimension. What do you think? We're talking about the movie musical tonight. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Is that a dimension you want to go to? Marilyn's calling. Welcome, Marilyn. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I just wanted to tell you very briefly that I grew up with musicals. My favorite musical, which I'm not going to talk about, is Cabaret. Uh-huh. I could see it another 25 times for 100 reasons, but that's not what I'm going to talk about. Mm-hmm. I want to tell you that I saw West Side Story when it first came to Boston in the theater, in the Schubert Theater. Mm-hmm. I was with a Chinese woman who had been raised under Chinese teachers in China. Her parents had brought her here. She was a mathematician. We were both studying dance together.
What did she make of it?
She had been looking for the American, what she found in China. She said, in China, I pledge my life to China. I was looking for what do I do in America. At the end of the first act, which I'll never forget this, the audience gasped. And this woman turned to me and she said, her face shining, that's it. That's the American spirit I've been looking for. She was really talking about the power of the dance. And what I want to do is just quickly compare that with the movie. I was so eager to see the movie because I loved West Side Story. It's my favorite after Cabaret.
So did it send you?
No. As soon as I saw the dance of the movie, I was crushed. I thought, this is nutty. I mean, it just because in the play, the dance carried forward the storyline in a way that I had never seen before in theater.
And the movie didn't do it for you. Marilyn, thanks for your call. Thomas Hischek, I want you to get your response to Marilyn's perspective there. Did you see that that shift from stage to screen in West Side Story?
Oh, it's so obvious. The movie is filmed on the streets of New York, part of it. Mm. And at the very beginning, realistic New York, come down, and not only is the first movement in the show dancing, it's ballet. And so you've got these gangs starting to do ballet as they go down the street. It was so jarring. I think half the audience wanted to run out of the room, and the other half were just entranced by it. I think it's a difficult show to watch because of that. It has got the gritty realism of the sets. Not all of it was New York. They just filmed parts of it there. But it was never going for a romanticized view of New York. And then you've got this very high, you know, romanticized singing and dancing, even though it was pretty tough stuff. I think I can understand people's coldness to the movie. Some people feel the same way about the play, but I think on stage the reality is so different. They come out immediately and they start walking and they start moving into dance, and I don't think anybody is thrown. But in that movie, you had to accept those first 4 or 5 minutes, and if you couldn't, then it was a terminal experience.
It did not work for Marilyn. You know, then if we leap way ahead, just a couple of years ago, still playing last year, Moulin Rouge. Ghirardelli, this is something new again.
Yeah, this is you know, Baz Luhrmann, an Australian. I think it's his second film, and he came out of theater. What he did was he took a very standard, you know, musical format theme, boy meets girl, boy falls in love with girl, they have all sorts of troubles, she has consumption. But what he did was he set it in the past and then brought new music, current music, to draw the audience in. And then what he did was, remember we were talking about how Fred Astaire said you had to have a complete shot of the body.
Right, the whole body dancing.
And that Busby Berkeley had the gliding shots. He did a lot of quick
cut,
shots,
cut,
close-ups, jumping, scenes, just really kept it fast-paced so people would get engaged with it in a very positive way. And he did reinvent, and he did bring new people back to the genre. With Chicago and Moulin Rouge, this is the new school. This is what's going to be, we're going to be seeing with musicals from now on.
Let's hear a little Moulin Rouge.
William Best.
Pigeon. After spending the night with you, how did he refuse?
What's his type? Wilting flower. Bright and bubbly. Or smoldering temptress.
Cache, smoldering temptress. We're all relying on you, Gosling. Remember, a real show in a real theater with a real audience. And you'll be...
a real actress.
Cause that's...
Oh,
Nicole Kidman in Moulin Rouge, quick cuts and new school. Thomas Hischek, is this where we're headed in Moulin Rouge in Chicago? All quick cuts and the kind of, is it the influence of the music video on the movie musical?
Oh, there's no question it's the movie, you know, the video is coming in here. And there's no question it's the future, at least immediate future, love it or not. I think the idea of presenting a musical like a commercial, you know, where everything is crammed together, or a music video, where everything is visual, the music is just, you know, you can't just sit and listen to the music. That's not the point. The point is you have to be seeing things. And if the people aren't moving, in the case of Moulin Rouge, the camera is always moving, beside being, you know, the cross-cutting. And I don't know if it's going to, it's a trend that's going to last a long time. The downside of it, several people have pointed out, is it doesn't really trust the audience very much. It assumes they have a very short attention span.
And you don't get that old flow from story to stage.
Mm-hmm. Pardon?
You don't get that old flow from story to stage, it seems to me. Thomas Hischek, we are, I'm sorry to say, out of time, but I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Well, a great pleasure.
It's been terrific. Thomas Hischek is professor of theater at the State University of New York in Cortland and author of the upcoming book, Through the Screen Door, What Happens to Broadway Musicals When They Went to Hollywood. Garen Daly, thanks so much for being in tonight.
My pleasure, and Tom, break a leg.
Okay, break a leg, you too, my friend. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. Let's go out listening to No Business Like Show Business from Annie Get Your Gun. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Traveling through the country is so thrilling. Standing out in front on opening nights. Smiling as you watch the benches filling. And see your billing up there in lights.
There's no like show people, they smile when they are alone.
In a moment, I'll be rejoined by On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
The benefits of this tax relief will be felt throughout the economy. Abolishing double taxation of dividends will leave nearly 35 million Americans with more of their own money to spend and invest, which will promote savings and return as much as $20 billion this year to the private economy.
North Korea has thumbed its nose at the international community. This is very regrettable. It's a sad statement on the part of the North Koreans of the respect in which they hold their own people. This makes it more difficult to find a solution.
There is still no evidence that Iraq has fundamentally changed its approach from one of deceit to a genuine attempt to be forthcoming in meeting the Council's demand that it disarm.
I don't think there's any question but that Democrats will take every step available to us to ensure that this Pickering nomination doesn't go forward. I am really surprised that in light of what's happened in recent weeks, the administration would insist on having a debate of this kind.
I came here tonight, Sharon said, to respond to the despicable libel that has been made against me with one purpose, to bring down the government in Israel and to seize power through lies.
We should remain the closest ally of the United States. And as allies, influence them to continue broadening their agenda. We are the ally of the US, not because they are powerful, but because we share their values.
I, Nancy Pelosi,
do solemnly swear,
that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States.
That I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States.
That I will well and faithfully discharge.
And that I will well and faithfully discharge.
The duties of office.
The duties of office.
On which I am about to enter.
On which I am about to enter.
So help me God.
So help me God.
And there's a week President Bush unveils his $674 billion economic stimulus package. Colin Powell today condemns North Korea's decision to pull out of the nuclear non-proliferation treaty. The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, John Negroponte, reacts to the latest report from U.N.'s weapons inspectors. Chief Weapons Inspector Hans Blix said he has yet to find a smoking gun, but criticized Iraq for not cooperating with inspectors. President Bush renominates controversial Judge Charles Pickering to a federal appeals court bench and earns outrage from Senate Democrats, including Tom Daschle there. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon defends himself against accusations of corruption as his popularity continues to slip, heading up to January 28th elections in Israel. Britain's Prime Minister Tony Blair defends his nation's close relationship with the U.S. And Nancy Pelosi takes over as House Minority Leader, the first female ever to head one of the major parties in Congress. Jack Beatty, the week got off to a bang with President's big economic stimulus plan.
Yes, it did. The president, I may be wrong about this, but the president, I think, has characterized two things as unfair since he was used that word since he's been president. One was the double taxation involved in taxing estates over $2 million. And, of course, some of that isn't double taxation. And the second was the double taxation involved in taxing dividends. These were the perhaps he's used the word unfair for other things, but those are the two that I recall. Well, now he's moved to end the taxation, the double taxation on dividends. And, you know, I'm beginning to think that the administration's that this could be a fateful month for the administration, and that if Mr. Bush fails of reelection in 2004, decisions made now could be the reason. This stimulus bill, as everybody says, and as even the White House admit, isn't going to stimulate. And if it doesn't stimulate, and if unemployment remains as it is, which Mr. Bush has lost jobs since he's been president, if that continues, and he goes ahead with a war in Iraq that has a contractionary effect, he's going to be facing the situation that his father faced.
So no short-term stimulus, perhaps, although there are elements here that the White House says would have that effect. But overall, there's a longer horizon on this if you look at it as Bush looks at it.
Yes. And you know, he could have gone in the direction of just putting money in the pockets of people who will spend it, as the Democrats want, and giving money to the states, who will spend the money. In fact, this could actually be a tax increase bill, as Senator Schumer pointed out, because states now are going to have to, whose tax codes are woven into the federal code, mm-hmm. are now going to have tax cuts to deal with, as much as $4 billion if this goes through.
We'll have to see how this all comes out. There are still Republicans who are dragging their feet on this. It may not go through as put forward, but your notion of a fateful month certainly feels like it may be the case. Colin Powell reacting today to North Korea's new moves. That potential second war front is really heating up.
It is. And, I just can't. I wish this administration had been listening to Colin Powell right from the start. I mean, last year he said, we want to continue with the Clinton policy. We want to favor the warming of relations between North and South Korea. And the White House essentially repudiated that. And I think in part we are paying for that. And at a certain point, a hard line isn't going to work. North Korea has been asking for one thing for now for nearly 15 years. They want a non-aggression pact with us, and they want oil in return. And they told Madeleine Albright this. They will stop sending weapons abroad. They will scrap their missiles, and they will scrap their bombs. It looks like a better and better deal with each passing day.
Sounds like you might take it, Jack. Meanwhile, on the other front, Iraq. And no smoking gun, but no end to the scrutiny either.
No, and mixed messages about Iraq. On the one hand, tough talk from Ambassador Negroponte. On the other hand, the same split in the administration. Secretary Powell saying, well, it's going to take more time. And the British Foreign Secretary saying, actually this week, that odds are 60-40 against a spring invasion because of the complications with the inspectors, because of cold feet, perhaps even in Whitehall, and certainly cold feet in Turkey.
And yet it does feel, as you say, Jack, like a potentially fateful month in the way that crises, once they start to spring up, can or even tend to multiply.
Isn't that something? They come in bunches. And this is the case for Mr. Bush right now.
A bunch right across the world, from Persian Gulf to North Korea, even on our own southern front with Venezuela, things really cooking. Jack, a lot to talk about next week. We look forward to having you back then. Have a great weekend. Thanks for being with us tonight.
You too, and thank you very much.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Cassettes and CDs of On Point are available for $15. Go to onpointradio.org or call 1-800-909-9287. This is WBUR. We're